Hello and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. There are acclaimed modern favourites like We Live in Time and Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy. Absolute all-timers, such as The Graduate and Breathless. And what about an Evil Dead bonanza? How about the likes of Evil Dead 2 and Evil Dead Rise? For this episode, we're delving into the world of Hammer, the legendary British studio, renowned in particular for its horror cinema. Now, my guest is something of a legend too. He's journalist, film critic and horror expert Kim Newman. Now, he's picked a lesser known Hammer movie to chat about, and we'll be getting into Demons of the Mind from 1972. Here, though, a clip from the film, just to set the scene.
The moon affects tides and oceans. It affects the universal fluid. It affects us all in some way.
But not like these nightmares. A bloodlust coursed through me. I relished the thought, the very idea of blood. Like my ancestors before me, I saw myself an evil demon of the forest, lusting to kill.
Kim, a very, very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. How do we find you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here. Before we get going, one thing we always ask of our guests is just a little film fact about them. I should note that you're sat in front of a TARDIS, which is a good place to start. But maybe, I don't know, what was the first film you remember seeing?
Oh, I can tell you the first film I saw. I mean, but quite often when I'm asked that question, I say it was the First Men in the Moon, the Ray Harryhausen epic, scripted by Nigel Neal, based on H.G. Wells' novel, starring Lionel Jeffries, Edward Judd and Martha Heyer. And it's a terrific picture, and it's exactly relevant to all my grown-up interests, so it's a perfect origin point for me. But of course, it's not true. The first film I saw was the B picture with First Men in the Moon, which was East of Sudan, a completely forgotten imperial adventure story with Anthony Quayle and Jenny Agutter, which is mostly constructed around stock footage from older versions of The Four Feathers. I have actually, you know, looked at it relatively recently, just out of sort of historical interest, because it is the first film I saw. And yeah, it's kind of fun in a silly sort of way.
I mean, that's a fork in your career, isn't it, really? If you'd have gone for the B picture and followed that path, it would be a very, very different life that you'd led.
True, but nobody followed the B pictures. Although, actually, now I come to think of it, I saw Demons of the Mind on a double bill with Tower of Evil, a rather splendid, lurid slasher movie from the early 70s.
So before we just get to Demons of the Mind and that double bill, interestingly enough, for those unfamiliar, can you just set up what Hammer was and what Hammer is and why it's important in British cinema? Good luck with that, Kim.
Yeah, there's a whole podcast series about that, or indeed several. The thumbnail sketch is that Hammer is a firm founded by the Carreras and Hines families in the 1930s. In the 1950s, they specialised in not just B-pictures, but quota quickies, those really inexpensive British films that filled out supporting features because there was a law that said a certain percentage of cinema screens had to be devoted to domestic pictures. They specialised in making films with imported American stars that were about an hour long. Anyway, after a while doing that, they hit on the notion of making gothic horror films in colour, which was very unusual at the time, although not quite unprecedented. House of Wax had done it a bit earlier. They made The Curse of Frankenstein with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, then Dracula with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. They also did The Mummy with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. So you get the picture. And in fact, there was a whole behind-the-scenes creative team. So they reinvigorated the sort of classic monsters who were off screens for about 10 years. I mean, the conventional wisdom is that all those great, you know, Frankenstein, Dracula type characters that started out being terrifying in the 1930s had got a bit old hat. And Universal, who made those films, had made Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Yes.
And the thought was in the 1950s, Nobody took those seriously. Hammer then took those characters seriously and created the tradition of Hammer horror, which is kind of where we come in.
I mean, the traditional Hammer horror film, to my eyes, and my eyes are nowhere near as trained as yours on this topic, is there's generally a very big, creepy house, that very colour, and Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. And so we asked you about Hammer, and you settled on this film, Demons of the Mind, which isn't that. Can you just set up Demons of the Mind for us?
It's got a big old house.
It does have a house.
There was a possibility that Peter Cushing might star in it. Yeah. Anyway, the films we just were talking about were made in the late 50s. And then in the 1960s, Hammer made a bunch of sequels. They made, like, Taste the Blood of Dracula and Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed, Frankenstein Created Woman, all that stuff, and a bunch of other horror or horror-adjacent titles. But by the early 1970s, the cycle was kind of on its last legs. Sort of younger filmmakers had come in and made quite startling pictures, which made Hammer look a bit staid. And Michael Carreras, who was the son of the longtime owner and sort of general boss of Hammer, James Carreras, bought the company from his father and tried to expand the notion of what a Hammer film could be. And he greenlit a lot of odd projects, some of which are fascinating, some of which really don't work.
Yeah.
But what I think Demons of the Mind does is it's the Hammer film's equivalent of those westerns that Sam Peckinpah or Sergio Leone were making, which were looking at the fundamental assumptions of the genre. And so Demons of the Mind is a very kind of self-referential film. It's basically a werewolf story, but it's a psychological take on werewolves. It's a family curse story. It's a gothic story.
Oh, interesting.
But it doesn't quite give you the things that you assumed would be true in a Hammer film are not true in Demons of the Mind. So it's a revisionist horror film.
I mean, I've read this described as coming from Hammer's fearless early 70s era, was the phrase that I read.
You say fearless, some people say desperate. You know,
well, I was going to say, is this a point of a last roll of the dice kind of approach to its horror catalog?
Hammer rolled the dice a lot. Actually, in the early 70s, Hammer were very successful company making on the buses movies, spin-offs of terrible ITV sitcoms.
All three of them. Yep, watch them all.
Films that even Hammer fans find really, really difficult to watch. And what's more, the on the buses films, they're better than the Lovely Neighbor film. You know,
they are. I'll give you that.
But among the crazy ideas Hammer had at the time are things like Dracula AD 1972, Dracula in Chelsea and chicks in miniskirts. It's sort of basically it's Dracula AD 1968, but they didn't quite get it done in time. But then they made like Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires, Kung Fu versus vampires. And they were throwing wild, crazy ideas out there to shake up the formula. Some of the films worked better than some of the others. I actually quite like a lot of the really quirky things. Straight On Till Morning, which is another Studio Canal release. It was sold as a love story from Hammer Films, and it's about a girl who falls in love with a psychopath, of course.
So in terms of the perception that Demons of the Mind was a deliberate push to do something different as well, was there any, outside of the commercial necessity of trying other things, in terms of the creatives involved, do you detect a push to go more ambitious?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The project was initiated by a writer called Christopher Wicking, who I should say was a friend of mine and a collaborator and somebody I regard very highly. He had written a bunch of films or co-written a bunch of films for American International Pictures, who had a London office, and they were actually Hammer's biggest rival.
Oh, interesting.
And for them, Chris had written a Scream and Scream Again, I think it's the best of them, but he'd done The Oblong Box and Murders in the Rue Morgue. But he got annoyed with them, as you do, through front office interference and all kinds of problems. And so at one point he just got up, left the building, crossed Wardour Street to Hammer House and sort of did that thing of like applying for political asylum. or basically, he walked over the road and went to the competition and said, look, can I work here? And Michael Guerrero's liked his work and hired yeah. him to write a mummy movie, Blood from the Mummy's Tomb, which I really like. The thing about Demons of the Mind is I think it's the only produced script Chris wrote, which is entirely his. It's his idea. It's his story. Yeah. It's not rewritten by anybody. It's exactly what he intended. Almost everything else he did was an adaptation of somebody else's novel or someone else's earlier script or an entry in a series that had already been going. Demons of the Mind is like ground up Chris. And the director, Peter Sykes, was relatively new to Hammer. He later did To the Devil a Daughter. And he'd done a few other odd, interesting pictures.
I mean, Christopher Wicking, I was reading about him just before. You say he was a friend of yours. I mean, he died tragically young at, what, 65, I think it was.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
I've just been reading a long obituary of him. And it strikes me he wrote this, what, in his late 20s?
That's right, yeah.
It's quite early in his career for something so bold.
A circumstance that I think Chris had mixed feelings about was that he started work in the late 60s when there was a production boom in yeah. Britain. But at some point in the mid 70s, due to economic factors, that boom came to an end. Yeah. And at that time, he was actually working for Hammer as a script editor. And so his credits sort of stopped. He wrote for television. He wrote some good episodes of The Professionals. And he became a rewrite man. He became one of the best film doctors in the right. business. But the era when you could go to AIP or Hammer or Amicus or Tigon or any of these other little British companies and say, if you can get Peter Cushing or Christopher Lee, I've got a horror script. And like the next week, they'd be filming it. That stopped in about 1973. And I don't think it ever came back, which is sad. But that means that Chris had a period of being very prolific. Yeah. But before about 1965, almost nobody who worked in the British film industry actually wanted to. You know, it was like people ended up in it somehow. But from about 1965 on, suddenly you had young people who'd grown up with the movies, yeah. who grew up watching them. Whereas in Britain, the tradition had always been the theatre yeah. or literature. So if you were an actor or a director, you wanted to be at the RSC. You wanted to be putting on plays in the West End, and films were something you sort of did, yeah, in order to pay the school fees. But Chris grew up as a child of the cinema, somebody who in the 1950s as a kid was going to the movies all the time. Films were what he loved, and he loved American westerns and film noir. He wrote a really interesting book called The American Vein about directors of American television series yeah. as well. I mean, so he was going in and talking to executives who really weren't that well up on film history. They weren't particularly well up on, you know, even the literary sources of the films that they wanted to yeah. make. Chris was interested in modern horror writing, for instance, which was not something that there are very few Hammer films based on contemporary novels. Yeah. It's like in the 1970s, they wanted to make films based on Dennis Wheatley's novels from the 1930s. Whereas, weirdly, their big rival, Amicus, the producer there, Milton Subotsky, bought Stephen King's stories. He knew where the future was.
He did Cat's Eye, didn't he?
No, he has a producer credit on Cat's Eye because he once owned the rights.
That's right. Because he didn't have the money to finish it, did he? That was it.
That's right. He also was one of the first people to say that Marvel comics would really work in the movies. He wanted to make Spider-Man yeah. in the 1960s, yeah. and he wanted Lenny Bruce to write it and Bob Dylan to play Peter Parker. That didn't work, but what a shame.
What a shame. Yeah. What a shame.
But this was not a general attitude. Most of the people who were greenlighting yeah. you know, British genre films were a bit staid and stuffy. I think Chris sort of came in under the wire with a bunch of other filmmakers who were young and exciting and maybe refreshingly actually wanted to make these films.
So I've come to Demons of the Mind for the first time and you picked it I watched it.
I would have thought by now everybody has seen every Hammer film.
But, well, you say that, but I talked to a few people about it. This is one of those that appears to be under quite a lot of people's radars, even with the release and restoration that it's just had. It was quite, it was quite a surprise to unearth it. I was fascinated by the cast list of it. Because, I mean, you talked before about the Peter Cushings and the Christopher Lee. It's interesting who's not in it. But also, I mean, Paul Jones. I mean, what is he? Number one hit single with Doo Wah Diddy Diddy. And then he's like one of the leads in a Hammer movie.
Yeah.
I mean, can you take me into the casting of it?
In between, he had made a Peter Watkins film, Privilege. And he actually, I've got to say, he was the lead singer of Manfred Mann. And he had a solo career as well. So he's actually quite a talent. But he is not. And you're right, he is not the normal choice for a Hammer leading man. But that's true of the whole of the cast. I mean, Chris actually said he wouldn't have minded Peter Cushing in the lead. But for some reason, there were several other sort of respectable names. I know Paul Scofield was attached to it for a while, but they ended up with Robert Hardy, who Chris actually wasn't that keen on. I think the performance really works, but it's the case that he is surrounded by people who are weirdly more interesting than he is, and particularly Michael Horton, Patrick McGee, Yvonne Mitchell, Gillian Hills, Shane Bryan, Virginia Wetherill. Yeah, you kind of have to be, sort of first or second level in your film knowledge to know who these people are. But they're all diamonds. They're all absolutely astonishing talent. Yeah, there's not a dud note in that supporting cast. And they're asked to do things which are unusual.
Yes. Do you know, that is a sentence that's doing quite a lot of lifting there, Kim. They are indeed asked to do things that are on the... I'm skating around a relatively spoiler-light version of this conversation. Again, having been relatively new to the film. I'm curious your first viewing of it and your instant reaction when you saw it.
I first saw this in 1973 at the Palace Bridgewater on a double bill with Tower of Evil. Yeah. At that time, I was going to see whatever horror films came round. Neither of them had that much of a reputation. I remember me and my mates debating whether to go and because we could only go and see one program that week. And the classic on the other side of the road was showing an Italian horror double bill of Night of the Damned and Something Creeping in the Dark, which had really lurid trailers. So we were sort of torn. We ended up going for the British double bill, which may not actually have been the right call because the other films became very, very difficult to see later. It took me a long time to track them both down, but I suspect on sheer entertainment value.
Yeah.
Tower of Evil is objectively a terrible film, but I love it. I mean, it is camp in a way that surprisingly few horror films actually are. There's a sort of image of horror films as sort of kitsch and silly, but Tower of Evil genuinely is. I mean, it's a mind-stretching farrago of nonsense set on a bleak island with a lighthouse with gurning maniacs in the cellar. And
I love it already.
Phoenician artifacts, and it's got slashers, and it's got Robin Asquith in it.
Oh, crikey.
Derek Folds from Basil Brush and Yes Minister. and it's like full of... And this was one of the things that, as kids, was really sort of fascinating, is that British horror and indeed British sex films were all full of people who were like show business mainstream legends, people you'd see on children's television.
Yeah.
Indeed, Michael Horden is a sort of much loved British character actor who is completely off the chain in Demons of the Mind, playing the character that Peter Cushing would normally play. He is the wandering religious man, the man who knows how to deal with demons, but he's also a maniac. I mean, he leads a righteous mob of absolute idiots to do terrible things. And I think that's something that Chris brought to it. He looked at the established morality of Hammer horror, where you would have a Dr. Van Helsing figure. And in quite a few of the Dracula films, it's an actual priest. Quite often you have these sort of staunch, muscular Christians standing up against Dracula. And Chris's his sensibilities are formed in the 1960s, and there was a sort of a distrust of all that. I think deep down in the script, there's a lot of influence from the then popular psychiatrist, R.D. Lang, who said that families were bad for you. and in fact, that's a theme in British horror. Families are really bad for you. It's full. It's full of parents and children doing terrible things to each other and to other people. But just in case you thought you could rely on science, on the other side of the film, you have Patrick McGee as an early psychoanalyst, and he's mad too. Yeah, and he's also a danger to anybody. And we see some truly gruesome kind of early treatments for mental illness, which are authentically researched and horribly upsetting. And I think that that's a thing that's unusual, or was unusual in Hammer, is that it's actually rather an uncomfortable watch. It doesn't give you, the titillation of, vicariously enjoying licentiousness and evil, followed by Dracula getting a stake through his heart and bells on the soundtrack and a sense that order is restored to the world. What you get at the end of Demons of Mind is not that at all. The sense that there is this situation that can never be made better.
Again, not spoiling it for people, but the final shot of it, you look at something like St. Maud now or something like that, a lineage and a half.
Oh, absolutely.
So you come out of it in 1973, and by the sounds of it, it made a real impact on you.
Yeah.
What was the general consensus around the film at the time? Was this regarded as a success?
I saw it in 1973 on its first release, and it's a film that was made in 1971, which says something, right? Yeah. It took a while to get released. It came out on a double bill. I believe Hammer didn't even press show it.
Yeah.
I think it was a case that by the time it came out, everybody involved had moved on to something else. The people who saw it liked it, and the one or two reviewers who got to it liked it. But like actually so many really interesting genre movies, you look in vain in the national press for, and this is true today as well, for any kind of useful criticism of this kind of material. It's still not something that most critics are set up to take seriously or to get the most out of.
So what was the aftermath of it for Hammer and for the people involved? Because it's only a couple of years later that it was, what, the inverted commas, last traditional Hammer film, wasn't it?
I mean, if we say that the last proper Hammer horror film is To the Devil a Daughter, Chris wrote that and Peter Sykes directed it. So obviously, the fact that the film wasn't a huge success did not hurt the careers of the people involved in house. Yeah. The writer and the director both got more work out of it. I think the careers of the actors were neither one thing nor the other. I mean, Patrick McGee went on being Samuel Beckett's favorite actor, but also making films for Lucio Fulci and Valerian Borovchik.
Yeah.
Michael Horton was on television playing dithering old comedy characters for the rest of his life. Gillian Hills quit the business and had two other hugely successful careers as a commercial artist and as a pop singer. So, it didn't hurt people.
So for those listening to this then, who are tempted to give the film a try, perhaps haven't dug it out before, what would you say to them? What kind of things would you say in particular for them to look for?
Probably the thing to do is to go in blind, because it is quite a surprising film.
That's exactly what I did.
And I would sort of highlight maybe the quality of the dialogue is stronger than most horror films. Chris is a very thoughtful writer. And, just in terms of sort of sit back and be astonished, watch the performances that Michael Horden and Patrick McGee are giving. I also think that Gillian Hills and Shane Bryan are really disturbing as the kind of evil twins.
You're lying. I can see her. She's lying, bleeding. She needs me.
Emily.
Elizabeth!
I watched the film and I was talking to Queenie, our producer, about it. My confession to her was, I don't know what to say about it. Because as much as I went into the film cold, there is, when you see the Hammer logo, still some degree of preconception of what you're going to get. And also some of the ingredients of Hammer are still relatively familiar. It is that gorgeous old house that's clearly got something wrong with it. And so I'm curious now what I'm going to get from a second viewing of it.
Well, you know where it's going. I mean, this is that's an insane thing to say, but the first time, and this is not just true of this film, it's probably true of any film in any genre. First time, you get shock and surprise. Second time, you get tragedy. You get knowing where this is going, knowing, yeah, which is a different mode. I suspect that the character beats land deeper. One of the things I think this film does, which, it, I mean, and it's a deliberate tactic, is it makes the incidental deaths more affecting. We don't just get the kind of incidental casualties that quite a lot of horror films have, where somebody dies just to have something gruesome happen. When people die in here, and even characters who aren't necessarily sympathetic, you sort of feel upset, you know, at their sufferings and at what happens to them.
So Demons of the Mind is available now on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray. This has been an absolute delight. Kim Newman, thank you so much for joining us on the Studio Canal Presents podcast.
Always a pleasure.
Demons of the Mind is now available on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray. Now it's our usual roundup of the latest goings-on in the world of Studio Canal. So on the 17th of August 2026, we get the Peter Sellers Centenary Collection on Blu-ray. This 8-disc set celebrates the sheer range of one of the UK's best ever performers. Included is a new and exclusive 4K restoration of 1957's The Smallest Show on Earth. Alongside, well, deep breath, you've got The Lady Killers, Carlton Brown of the FO, I'm All Right Jack, Two Way Stretch, Only Two Can Play, The Wrong Arm of the Law, and Heavens Above. You get a 32-page booklet included in the set as well. And if you're after an added Peter Sellers fix, why not dig back into the archives of this show? We examine the complicated genius of the man right back in episode 40. Meanwhile, in cinemas on the 4th of September here in the UK, 1991's Terminator 2 Judgment Day, one of the biggest blockbusters of its time, is heading back into cinemas to mark its, crikey, 35th birthday. From director James Cameron, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton and Robert Patrick, the much-loved hit will be back on the big screen in 4K, real 3D and premium formats. Check out your local listings to see when the T-800 will be appearing again somewhere near you. And that brings us to the end of this latest episode of the Studio Canal Presents podcast. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal Films as it happens and to find out more about the Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram and TikTok. Until the next time, to be honest, all this horror this episode has spooked me out. I'm just off to hide. Back soon. Ta-ta for now.